Ralph Stein of Lincoln, Gerald Griffin Sheehan Jr. of Lynn, Alfred W. Blago of Newton, Charles C. DeCourcy of Norton, Stephen K. Parker of Norwood, Charles C. DeCourcy of Plainville, Charles C. DeCourcy of Revere, Anne F. Bouze of Wakefield, Anne F. Bouze of Waltham, Charles C. DeCourcy of Watertown, John F. Rice, Gerald Griffin Sheehan Jr. of West Yarmouth, Ralph Stein of Westboro, Gerald Griffin Sheehan Jr. of Winchester, John F. Rice of Woburn, John F. Rice. Those are the obituaries as published in today's Boston Globe, dated Tuesday, February 24th, 2026.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJ. Framingham.
And coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Boston Herald. Please stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to readings from the Boston Herald. Tuesday, February 24th, 2026. Read to you by Steve Malisi. The Blizzard of 26. Massachusetts pounded by nor'easter that sparks travel ban. Power restoration will take days. Those who violate the travel ban can face a $500 fine. Had enough yet? An historic nor'easter pummeled the region on Monday, with one spot even breaking the snow record from the blizzard of 78, as power crews work around the clock to try to restore electricity for hundreds of thousands. Power restoration will take days following the hurricane force wicked winds and heavy wet snows, official warn. The severe and serious storm led Governor Maura Healey to issue a travel ban for the hardest hit areas, dealing with treacherous roads, limited visibility, blowing and drifting snow, downed power lines, and fallen trees. Hundreds of vehicles were reported stranded on state roads, according to Mass State Police. Meteorologists were measuring in feet, not inches, for this whopper, as more than 3 feet of snow were dumped on parts of Rhode Island. The jackpot zone for Massachusetts was in Bristol and Plymouth counties, where more than 30 inches of snow was recorded. It was a record-breaking storm for Providence, Rhode Island. The measurement of 37.9 inches of snow at T.F. Green International Airport broke the record for the city's greatest single snowstorm on record. The previous mark was 28.6 inches, set during the blizzard of 78. This is a very impressive storm, said National Weather Service meteorologist Andy Nash, who noted all the wind damage and significant power outages across the region. When plow crews are dealing with more than 1 inch an hour, they can't keep up, he added. This was 3 to 4 inches an hour at times, and that is just impossible to plow and keep things manageable, leading to big travel problems. Healey, during a midday blizzard update, announced an executive order to ban non-essential motor vehicle travel in Bristol, Plymouth, and Barnstable counties due to the dangerous road conditions. That ban was later extended to Martha's Vineyard. Those who violate the travel ban can face a $500 fine. We needed to do this because this is a particularly hard-hit area, Healey said during a press conference at the State Emergency Operations Center in Framingham. We need to have the ability for all essential vehicle travel to be able to go through, and anybody who doesn't need to be on the road should not be on the road. Those who are exempt from the travel ban include first responders, public emergency personnel, utility crews, food and fuel delivery, and medical staff. The governor also activated an additional 150 members of the Massachusetts National Guard to assist with the response. Mass State Police reported more than 400 disabled motor vehicles as of 4 p.m. Monday. State Police, National Guard, and Mass DOT were helping free the vehicles or transporting the occupants to a safe location. State Police Deputy Colonel Daniel Tucker noted the $500 fine for violating the travel ban. That's the last thing the state police wants to be dealing with, Tucker added. We just want the public to stay off the roads and let us do our job along with our partners at DOT and the National Guard. The travel ban will be lifted when Highway Administrator Jonathan Gulliver determines conditions are safe. Meanwhile, close to 300,000 households were in the dark at the peak of the storm amid incredibly strong winds on Monday, and it's expected to take days for many to get power back. The Cape had the most households without power, according to the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. More than 80% of Barnstable County was without power, more than 155,000 outages reported as of 5 p.m. Monday. Wind gusts surpassed 75 miles per hour on the Cape, which is hurricane force. More than 75,000 households were without power in Plymouth County, about 33% of the county. And Bristol County had around 15,000 outages, about 7% of customers there. More than 50% of Nantucket was without power, more than 8,000 customers. Wind gusts topped 80 miles per hour on Nantucket. And more than 40% of Martha's Vineyard was in the dark, also more than 8,000 households. Gloucester and Rockport on the North Shore were also hard hit. It's going to take days for power crews to get all that repaired across the region, said Nash, the National Weather Service meteorologist. Eversource and National Grid have extra crews staged, and they have more crews coming. But this takes time, Healy said at the press conference. The issue isn't crews. The issue is going to be access, Healy said. When does the wind die down enough so that it's safe for people to get out in bucket trucks? Also, the roads need to be cleared so the crews can get into those areas. Healy also directed that non-emergency executive department state employees should not report to their workplaces on Tuesday. She urged employers to consider having employees work remotely to the extent possible, especially those subject to the travel ban. The governor also told people to check in on their neighbors. She added that those who lose power and need to get to a warming center should call 211 for help. It was such a strong storm that even Market Basket shut down on Monday. Due to the severe weather today and for the safety of our associates and customers, the majority of Market Basket stores will be closing at noon, posted Market Basket, which noted that the stores remaining open were in lesser hit New Hampshire and Maine. Many are wondering how long will this snow stick around after last month's whopper caused big issues on streets and sidewalks. Some snow might melt this week with temps climbing into the upper 30s and low 40s, but unfortunately even more snow could be on the way. A clipper system may bring precipitation late Tuesday night into Wednesday, and another system could arrive late Thursday into Friday. It's still winter in the middle of February, Nash said. Unfortunately, it's not the end of the season. Boston Mayor Wu cancels schools, keeps snow emergency in effect Tuesday. Stay home. Mayor Michelle Wu urged everyone to stay home as the city works to dig out from the blizzard, adding that the parking ban and snow emergency will remain in effect until at least 6 p.m. Tuesday, and Boston Public Schools will be closed again. We saw upwards of 2 inches an hour for several hours and met the official criteria for a blizzard, as deemed by the National Weather Service, Wu said Monday evening at a City Hall press conference. The snow emergency remains in effect right now, and we need everyone to continue to stay home because going out can make things more difficult and dangerous for our public works teams and for first responders who are on the roads as well, the mayor added. Wu said the city's public works crews had 900 plows and snow spreaders out on the roads at the height of the storm, and still had almost 700 out as of about 5 p.m., as the city was hit with a second major snowstorm of the year. While parts of the state were hammered by Monday's blizzard, snowfall totals in Boston were below the 2 feet that fell in late January's massive storm. Wu said 40 inches of snow had fallen before the storm, which, per reports, brought another 10 to 14 inches throughout the city. Still, the storm will provide another test for the Wu administration, which was criticized for its poor snow removal results following last month's nor'easter. Wu said there were about 25 downed trees reported and limited power outages that have mostly been resolved. The number of power outages in Boston has been far less than we've seen in other parts of the state, the mayor said. City officials urged residents to have patience as plows may push snow back into curb cuts and spaces they may have already worked hard to clear on their property, and anticipate that snowbanks may hang around for a while before melting occurs. Wu stressed that residents should shovel out their sidewalks, cars, and nearby fire hydrants as soon as the snow does stop, so people can get around safely. Property owners are responsible for clearing out their sidewalks and curb ramps within 3 hours after it's stopped snowing, or 3 hours after sunrise if snow occurs overnight, and face fines and violations if they fail to do so. We are maintaining the snow emergency and parking ban until at least 6 p.m. Tuesday, Wu said. After the snow stops, please shovel out your car sooner than later so our plows don't have to redo their work. And try not to throw the snow into the street or into the sidewalk. Try to pile it in front of or behind cars. Wu said the city's public school system will be closed for a second straight day on Tuesday, and libraries and community centers won't open until noon. All other city buildings will operate on regular hours, the mayor added. Residents will have until 8 p.m. Tuesday, or 2 hours after the parking ban ends, to remove their cars from the city's garages that offer discounted rates for snow emergencies, according to the interim chief of streets, Nick Gove. The city has towed more than 676 cars as of 4 p.m. Monday, according to Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox. Trash and recycling pickup will be delayed for a day this week, Gove said. Space savers are allowed for 48 hours following the end of a snow emergency. Gove said public works crews will be working to clear snow in the coming days. He said snow removal will run through the weekend, but added that those efforts may be paused midweek for a forecasted small clipper system, potentially Wednesday into Thursday. We understand side streets are really tight in some neighborhoods, and we just ask for everybody's patience while we work through that, Gove said. Fortunately, we are not forecasting an extended period of sub-freezing conditions like we did last month. The Arctic temperatures that followed last month's nor'easter have led to limited melting leading up to this week's blizzard. Part of the cleanup involves moving the snow to snow farms in the city and melting it there, Wu said. Boston EMS Chief James Hooley said the snow is heavy and urged people to pace themselves when shoveling, particularly if they have underlying medical conditions, especially cardiac disease. Those with medical limitations should consider having someone else shovel snow for them, he added. As of Monday evening, there had been no tragedies reported in relation to the storm, Hooley said. Our number one goal is to make sure that everybody is safe, and then we want to get the city up and running, get schools back open as quickly as possible, and make sure that we remember that we are a winter city, Wu said. We are a New England city. We know how to do this. There will be piles of snow for some time as we continue to dig out, the mayor added. I ask for everyone's patience and thank you for being a good neighbor. Battenfeld. President Trump prepares for the speech of his life, by Joe Battenfeld. A politically toxic President Trump, suddenly a potential liability for Republicans in the midterm election, makes a critical State of the Union address Tuesday night in what could be a raucous and divisive affair. Trump comes to the primetime speech, the first of his second term, with declining support in the public and even the Supreme Court, and important decisions to make on the economy and a looming war against Iran. The speech could be the biggest of Trump's long political career. There's a lot on his plate, and critics are zeroing in on his mental state and behavior, including his recent tirade against the high court. It's going to be a long speech because we have so much to talk about, Trump said on Monday. With more and more Americans disapproving of ICE's tactics, Trump needs to find a middle ground to reassure the nation, which before the election supported his deportation policy. Some Democrats are planning to disrupt Trump's address, while others, including Senator Ed Markey, are planning to boycott the event and not show up at all. It comes at a tumultuous time in the country, with more than half the public voicing displeasure with his job performance and with the direction the country is headed in. Trump is hoping for some good vibes from the gold medal winning men's hockey team at the State of the Union, even offering up a military jet to fly them to Washington. Congressional leaders were trying to work out logistics to get them in the House chamber. But the gold medal winning Team USA women's hockey team declined his invitation to join him at the State of the Union, citing scheduling conflicts. It's actually more likely the players voted against him. It's now likely that Trump is becoming so politically poisonous that some Republicans will want to stay away from him in the midterms to avoid a historic rout in congressional elections. A big test will be in New Hampshire, where Trump endorsed GOP Senate candidate John E. Sununu and stabbed his loyal supporter, Scott Brown, in the back. But it turns out Brown, running against Sununu in the race for an open Senate seat, may be better off not having Trump on his side. Trump's endorsement may now be the kiss of death. The president has suffered repeated setbacks in the federal courts and even the conservative-tilted Supreme Court, which ruled 6-3 against his tariff plan. And Trump's tariffs have already driven up the cost of housing and new construction, as well as items like new cars, causing angst among voters. The president is no longer the powerful political force, even in the Republican Party, as more GOP lawmakers have quietly distanced themselves from him. Only the most loyal MAGA followers are staying with Trump. With a blue tsunami looming on the horizon this fall, Republicans are concerned voters will take it out on them for being associated with Trump and deliver a Democratic rout that dramatically reshapes the balance of power in Washington. Not only will Democrats try to impeach Trump yet again, there could be a movement to remove him forcefully from office by triggering the 25th Amendment. That would need to be signed off on by Vice President J.D. Vance, who is quietly preparing to run for the top job in 2028. The Patriots' to-do list at 2026 NFL Scouting Combine. It's that time of year again. To scout and interview prospects, tamper with free agents, and dish on everyone else around the NFL. Coaches, executives, and agents will descend on Indianapolis this week for the league's annual scouting combine. Officially, their business is to prepare for this April's draft, while unofficially, everyone will be hunting for intel on an evolving trade market and free agency next month. The Patriots have 11 picks heading into the draft, starting at number 31 overall, and roughly $36 million to play with in free agency, good for 11th most in the league, per over the cap. Having come one win shy of a Super Bowl title, here are the six most pressing items on Mike Vrabel and Elliott Wolff's to-do list to get the Patriots over the top. Number one, firm up the big board. It's safe to say Vrabel is playing catch-up. It's been just 2 weeks since he landed home after Super Bowl 60, giving him little time to study film of the top prospects. The good news is his organizational vision has been in place for a year, so Wolf and company have known what Vrabel wants for more than a year now. Prospects without a rugged play demeanor? Forget them. Players who come across as entitled? Cross them off too. But tough, smart, and selfless? Those traits will always be in vogue in New England, where the goal should be to trim the bottom of its draft board this week based on new information from medical evaluations and prospect interviews. Ideally, the Pats would tighten the top of their board as well, with their current targets at number 31 overall differentiate themselves based on interviews, medicals, and athletic testing. Number two, ready, set, tamper. Once upon a time, it was the worst-kept secret in the league. Now it's just business is being done. Even though the NFL does not permit negotiations between impending free agents and outside teams, meetings take place all over Indianapolis every year, from bars to coffee shops, restaurants, hotel lobbies, and other corners of the city. Front office members hold contract talks with player representatives to get a sense of their markets. By the end of the week, the Patriots might have a feel for how much, say, Alec Pierce will command on the open market as the top free agent wide receiver, or Romeo Doubs, arguably the second best wideout available. By gathering contract estimates and gauging player interest, Wolf and Company can begin mapping out plans A, B, C, and D ahead of free agency to best position themselves when business opens on March 9. Number 3, check in with the internal free agents. It's another small group this year, but the Patriots can't afford to lose all of their in-house free agents in the process of chasing outside names. Outside linebacker Clavon Chaisson and safety Jaylen Hawkins are the best players who could leave New England, followed by defensive tackle Kyrius Tonga and backup tight end Austin Hooper. Unlike external free agents, the front office is free to speak with these players and their reps at any time. Hawkins, Chaisson, and Tonga have expressed interest in returning, but, as always, it will come down to the right terms. If the Patriots were to lose Chaisson, they would have several replacement options in free agency, while there are fewer available safeties who could fill Hawkins' shoes. That supply could affect the team's willingness to retain Chaisson, who, at 26 years old, should have a wide market. Meanwhile, Hawkins might be able to leverage the Patriots into a more favorable deal, and Tonga and Hooper could be in take-it-or-leave-it type situations. Number 4. Explore the trade market. Max Crosby is reportedly trying to push his way out of Las Vegas. The Jaguars are supposedly shopping young receiver Brian Thomas Johnson Jr., and the Colts might try to offload Michael Pittman so that they can free up money to keep Pierce. And what about A.J. Brown, the longest rumored trade target in Patriots discourse? Whether the Pats ultimately swing a blockbuster deal or something smaller, odds are they will know where they stand as a suitor by week's end. All it will take for them is to set a few meetings with the teams, pull up at a restaurant or bar, and start talking. Number 5. Gather medical information. More than 40-yard dash times and bench press reps, the most important numbers to come out of the combine every year all pertain to medical evaluations. Most prospects will undergo a physical, which often prove vital because sometimes they unearth previously unreported injuries. Even if they don't, teams often move players up and down their boards based on injury risk alone. An injury risk may be the most undervalued factor in player evaluation. Fans only need to consider two examples from Patriots history to know the difference between a wise risk and a careless one. See Rob Gronkowski and 2014 first-round pick Dominique Easley. And number 6, set expectations. Wolf will meet with reporters Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Vrabel is scheduled to speak to the media Wednesday at 1 p.m. This is the time for both front-facing leaders of the organization to communicate with fans about how they view the current roster, this year's free agent crop, and the 2026 draft class. Even if they aren't spilling secrets, which they won't, it's important to know how closely Vrabel and Wolf believe the Patriots are to returning to the Super Bowl. Because internal decisions, like if the team plans to retain Stephon Diggs and how they intend to address the offensive line, will set the table for moves in free agency, the trade market, and draft that could push them toward the promised land. Whatever happens next, Wolf and Vrabel should leave behind a few breadcrumbs this week. Middlesex DA. Embattled Stady shouldn't testify in Lowell murder case. The DA opposes having Sergeant Scott Quigley testify during an evidentiary hearing. Defendants in a Lowell murder trial want one of the key investigators in their case to testify about a fatal cruiser crash he was involved in, allegedly while drunk, in a move to dismiss their trial over prosecutorial misconduct. But the Middlesex District Attorney's Office says that neither a hearing featuring testimony from the officer nor a dismissal are necessary. The revelation that State Police Sergeant Scott Quigley may have been drunk when he crashed his cruiser head-on into a wheelchair van in December 2023, causing injuries to an occupant that later killed him, paused the first-degree murder trial of brothers Billy, Channa, and Bilwaim Phan earlier this month. But now that the defense has been made aware of the alleged misconduct by Quigley, who was embedded with the Middlesex DA before the crash, and investigated the brothers for the 2020 murder of Tyrone Fett, the prosecutor in the case said that trial can and should continue as planned. The circumstances here in no way support the extreme remedy of dismissal of the indictments in a first-degree murder case, nor do they warrant an evidentiary hearing, Assistant District Attorney Thomas Brandt wrote in a filing dated February 22nd. Brandt maintained that although the DA's office was aware that Quigley had been in a serious accident, they were unaware of his alleged blood alcohol level during the crash until January 27. Although another government body, possibly the state police's Human Resources Department, might have had access to Quigley's blood alcohol prior to that date, Brandt wrote that that doesn't mean it was directly in possession of the prosecution. Once the prosecutors assigned to the case did become aware of that information, they disclosed it the very next day, Brandt wrote. The office immediately referred Quigley's case to the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office for a full and fair criminal investigation, Brandt said. Middlesex has also notified defendants in other cases investigated by Quigley of the allegations. Quigley has been suspended from the Mass State Police, and his lawyer told the Lowell Sun that the sergeant is not criminally liable in the crash. Brandt added that the office had no plans to call Quigley to the stand during the trial, and any plans by the defense to do so would be for the purpose of impeachment. It would also undoubtedly result in a trial within a trial, he added. But the defense isn't buying those arguments. The idea that Sergeant Quigley was able to hide his misconduct without assistance is extremely unlikely, Channa Fan's lawyer William Dolan wrote in response Monday. If it is true, then Commonwealth should be concerned that one of their investigators was a criminal mastermind. Dolan characterized the situation as a cover-up and criticized the DA's office for spending much of their opposition outlining that they had simply no reason to investigate the death of Angelo Scatino because the state police didn't tell them about the circumstances around the accident. That is disgraceful, Dolan wrote. It is their job to investigate deaths such as the one that came from Sergeant Quigley's crash. The defense also argued that some of the statements made in the Commonwealth's opposition have not been fully investigated. For example, the Commonwealth seeks the court to make a finding that medical records were not in their possession because a certain department of the state police had the records, Dolan wrote. That has yet to be actually addressed. Dolan noted that Quigley was on a first-name basis with an immunized witness set to testify against the Fan brothers, and that he failed to record interviews with that witness. Sergeant Quigley's credibility is an issue here. The credibility of the Commonwealth is an issue here, Dolan wrote. If the Commonwealth seeks the truth, they should not oppose a hearing on this issue. Feds investigate shooting at New Hampshire-Canada border crossing. Suspect hospitalized. The Border Patrol agent was unharmed in the incident, an agency spokesperson said. Concord, New Hampshire. Authorities are investigating a shooting near the country's northern border in New Hampshire, in which a person is accused of firing a gun at a Border Patrol agent who returned fire and struck the subject. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation said the incident occurred at about 1 a.m. Sunday morning in Pittsburgh, a town of about 800 people at the border with Canada. The FBI did not provide a name of the accused shooter, but said the person was receiving medical attention at a hospital. The Border Patrol agent, who the FBI also did not name, was unharmed in the incident, an agency spokesperson said. The shooting happened in a rural community that is home to the state's sole border crossing with the Canadian province of Quebec. The incident took place near the port of entry, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Rodney Scott said. The FBI's Boston field office will be investigating the shooting along with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of New Hampshire, authorities said. Initial reports indicate that the subject opened fire on the agent, at which time the agent returned fire, Scott said in the statement. CBP is cooperating fully with investigators. Officials with the FBI, CBP, and U.S. Attorney's Office declined to provide more detail on the accused shooter or the circumstances that led to the exchange of gunfire. The U.S. Attorney's Office said in a statement that information would be released if charges are brought against the person. Pittsburgh is about 150 miles north of the state capital of Concord. The town also borders Maine and Vermont, as well as Canada. The shooting took place near a usually quiet crossing in the only town in New Hampshire that borders Canada. That international border stretches for close to 60 miles. Casper. Schools fall short in teaching America's history. By Robert Casper. As we approach the 250th anniversary of the United States, I'm increasingly concerned that many of our K-12 schools, including here in Greater Boston, are failing to teach young people how to understand, appreciate, or even recognize the American story. The goal of education has never been blind nationalism. It is to ensure that the next generation inherits a shared civic identity, understands our founding principles, and feels some responsibility for preserving them. That foundation is now cracking. I've spent my entire life as a Massachusetts liberal. I grew up believing in the values that shaped this state: fairness, public service, civil liberties, support for the vulnerable, and pride in America's long democratic experiment. I supported reproductive rights, strong public institutions, and the separation of church and state, the full Massachusetts liberal package. Never once did I feel that loving this country contradicted those commitments. Patriotism wasn't something to whisper about. It was part of being a responsible citizen. That balance is increasingly missing from our schools. Recently, my organization documented how a particular ideological framework has taken hold in school systems across the country, reframing American history, civic identity, and even daily school culture through a narrow political lens. This is not a problem confined to distant places. It is happening right here in Massachusetts. In recent months, the Massachusetts Teachers Association circulated professional development materials that many parents, educators, and lawmakers described as inaccurate or divisive. As State Senator Walter Timoltes testified, "What we are seeing is indoctrination, not education, and it has no place in our public schools." His comments came during state house hearings examining how political content enters the training of roughly 120,000 educators statewide. The concern was not one rogue teacher or isolated incident. It was the broader message embedded in the materials, that America is defined almost exclusively by its failures, with little acknowledgement of its progress or its capacity for reform. Or consider the long-running disputes in Newton schools, which I attended growing up. For more than a decade, families have raised concerns about course materials that frame America's global role in a consistently lopsided way or assign students predetermined conclusions about controversial topics. A widely reported example of ideological focus in education involved a high school worksheet describing U.S. military actions solely as imperialist aggression, without presenting alternative perspectives or historical context. The district later revised the lesson, but the episode highlighted a broader drift away from balanced instruction and toward political framing. This shift matters. When education is filtered through ideology, students stop learning how to question, debate, and evaluate evidence. Instead, they learn how to conform. As U.S. Commissioner of Education Statistics Peggy Carr noted recently after the release of National Civics results, too many students are struggling to understand the basics of America's constitutional system. The data backs her up. National civics and history scores have fallen to record lows. Only 22% of 8th graders are proficient in civics. Many cannot name the three branches of government. Fewer still can explain the Bill of Rights. Even here in Massachusetts, long considered the nation's top-performing state, MCAS scores show troubling declines in core subjects like reading and math. Academic rigor is slipping at the very moment civic knowledge is becoming more essential. NAVI's report points to one reason: a teacher training pipeline that increasingly emphasizes activism over academic mastery. Unions and bureaucracies often promote political lenses as professional norms. Outside groups, including some funded by foreign governments, such as Qatar, offer ready-made lessons plans that districts adopt with too little scrutiny. In this environment, classrooms risk becoming echo chambers rather than spaces for inquiry. But it doesn't have to be this way. Massachusetts has long prided itself on leading the nation in education. Our public schools helped forge the civic culture of a young republic and define the American idea itself. As the cradle of American democracy, we should use the nation's 250th anniversary as an opportunity to reset, not by ignoring historical injustices, but by restoring a balanced civic education grounded in facts, reason, and confidence in America's capacity for self-correction. Students should learn about our failures and our achievements. They should study injustice and the institutions designed to remedy it. They should learn to recognize propaganda, whatever its political source. Above all, they should emerge as thoughtful, informed citizens capable of sustaining a free society. As America approaches its 250th birthday, we should expect our schools to commit to rigorous academics, honest history, and genuine civic formation. Our students deserve classrooms that prepare them for citizenship, and our Commonwealth can lead once again if we choose to. Volunteers scour the desert for Nancy Guthrie despite authorities urging them to stop. Several hundred people are working the Guthrie investigation, and more than 20,000 tips have been received, the sheriff's office has said. The FBI and other agencies are assisting. Tucson, Arizona. The disappearance of Today's Show host Savannah Guthrie's mother 3 weeks ago has inspired a small number of volunteers to launch their own searches in the dense desert near her home in hopes of cracking the case. The Pima County Sheriff's Department said while it appreciates the concern for Nancy Guthrie, it asked people inquiring about volunteering to give investigators space to do their jobs. "We all want to find Nancy, but this work is best left to professionals," the agency said in a statement over the weekend. Nancy Guthrie, 84, was last seen at her home just outside Tucson on January 31st and was reported missing the following day. Authorities believe she was kidnapped, abducted, or otherwise taken against her will. Drops of her blood were found on the front porch, but authorities haven't publicly revealed much evidence. Despite the sheriff's request for people not to search on their own, volunteers have continued to look. A small group reported finding a black backpack on Sunday, but it wasn't the same brand as one identified in video surveillance that FBI released of a masked man at Guthrie's home the night she disappeared. A sheriff's spokesperson told Tucson television station KOLD that the bag and its contents didn't appear to be viable leads. The Associated Press reached out to the sheriff's department for comment on Monday. Two women from the group, Madres Buscadoras de Sonora, or Searching Mothers of Sonora, who were carrying digging tools Sunday outside of Guthrie's home, said they too would join the search. They posted flyers on Guthrie's mailbox with her picture and their contact information. Tony Estrada, the former longtime sheriff in neighboring Santa Cruz County, said volunteer searchers have good intentions in wanting to help and can serve as a force multiplier. But it's crucial that their efforts be coordinated with law enforcement. You can't have people all over the place looking for something and not reporting to anybody or letting them know that they're going to be in that area, Estrada said. They may be trampling into things that may come out to be helpful in the future. Nearly all search operations for U.S. law enforcement agencies are staffed with volunteers, said Chris Boyer, executive director of the National Association for Search and Rescue. Untrained volunteers who show up to help in a search may mean well, but experts say they could end up contaminating a crime scene. It's painful for law enforcement when that happens, Boyer said. Volunteers should undergo background checks, be trained in things like administering first aid and preserving crime scenes, and work under the direction of law enforcement authorities, said Boyer, whose group provides education, certification, and advocacy for search and rescue efforts across the United States and other countries. Several hundred people are working the Guthrie investigation, and more than 20,000 tips have been received, the sheriff's office has said. The FBI and other agencies are assisting. The sheriff's office has watched around the clock lately at Guthrie's house. It also enacted a temporary one-way flow on the road so that emergency vehicles and trash collection trucks could get through. The constant presence of news crews, bloggers, and curious onlookers has drawn mixed reaction from neighbors. Some appreciated the attention the case has been getting. Others have placed traffic cones and signs on their properties to keep people off. Meanwhile, the tribute to Nancy Guthrie outside her home keeps growing, with flowers, yellow ribbons, crosses, prayers, and patron saints for older adults and in desperate situations. Aaron Aliamani and his daughter Ariana picked out a bouquet of red, pink, and white flowers and placed them at the edge of Guthrie's yard, alongside a sign that read, "Let Nancy come home," and a statuette of an angel. "My heart goes out to the entire family," said Aaron Aliamoni, who has known the Guthrie family for a long time. "We were all pulling for you. We're with you in your corner." Judge blocks release of special counsel report. A federal judge on Monday permanently barred the release of a report by special counsel Jack Smith on his investigation into President Donald Trump's hoarding of classified documents, a prosecution that was once seen as the most perilous of the four criminal cases the Republican faced. U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon, who was nominated by the bench by Trump, granted a request from the president to keep under wraps the report on an investigation alleging that Trump stored sensitive documents at his Mar-a-Lago estate after he left the White House following his first term and that he obstructed government efforts to get them back. Smith and his team produced a two-volume report on the classified documents investigation and a separate probe into Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election after he lost to Democrat Joe Biden. Both investigations produced indictments that were abandoned by Smith's team after Trump's November 2024 election win in light of longstanding Justice Department legal opinions that say sitting presidents cannot face federal prosecution. Attorney General Pam Bondi had already determined that the report was an internal deliberative communication that is privileged and confidential and should not be released outside the Justice Department, according to court papers. The Trump administration has characterized Smith's investigation as politically motivated and said in recent court papers that the report belongs in the dustbin of history. Cannon's order blocking the release also applies to Bondi's successors at the Justice Department. Cannon, who in 2024 dismissed the case after concluding that Smith was unlawfully appointed after multiple other favorable rulings for Trump, said the release of the report would present a manifest injustice to the president and his two co-defendants. Special Counsel Smith, acting without lawful authority, obtained an indictment in this action and initiated proceedings that resulted in a final order of dismissal of all charges, she wrote. As a result, the former defendants in the case, like any other defendant in this situation, still enjoy the presumption of innocence held sacrosanct in our constitutional order. Chioma Chukwu, executive director of American Oversight, said it will continue using every tool available to force this administration into the open and to defend the public's right to the truth through the release of this report. Body of civil rights leader Jesse Jackson is to lie in state in South Carolina. Jackson died after battling a rare neurological disorder that affected his ability to move and talk. Columbia, South Carolina. The Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. will be honored at the South Carolina Capitol in the state where he was born and where his crusade career as a civil rights activist started in high school by pushing to integrate his local library. Jackson's body will lie in state next Monday at the South Carolina State House, Governor Henry McMaster announced. Details were to be released later. Jackson, 84, died on February 17 after battling a rare neurological disorder that affected his ability to move and talk. He will lie in repose this week at the Chicago headquarters of his Rainbow Push Coalition. His body will then travel to South Carolina and Washington, D.C. for more celebrations of his life. A public service will be held in Chicago at House of Hope, a 10,000-seat church, on March 6, followed by private homegoing services the next day at Rainbow Push, which will be live-streamed. Jackson was born in 1941 in Greenville, South Carolina, in a tiny house on Haney Street just outside of downtown. A portion of the street will be named in his honor. He was the quarterback at segregated Sterling High School, where he led seven other black classmates into the whites-only public library in Greenville in 1960, where they sat and read books and magazines until they were arrested. It was the start of a long civil rights career during which Jackson became a protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., including joining the Voting Rights March King led from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. Jackson went on to run for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1984 and 1988. He continued to be active in his home state, pushing in 2003 for Greenville County to honor King by matching the federal holiday in his honor, and in 2015 by advocating for removing the Confederate flag from South Carolina Statehouse grounds after nine black worshipers were killed in a racist shooting at a Charleston church. Boston Mayor Wu endorses 79-year-old Ed Markey's Senate re-election bid. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu endorsed fellow progressive Democrat U.S. Senator Ed Markey in his re-election bid as the 79-year-old seeks a third Senate term. Wu's endorsement comes after Markey backed her twice for mayor, and as the senator looks to hold off a challenge from U.S. Representative Seth Moulton, a 47-year-old military veteran who is seen as a more moderate Democrat. Senator Markey has been a long-standing partner for Boston families, standing strong on our values, and delivering results by bringing resources and solutions, Wu said in a statement provided by Markey's campaign. He is a bold leader on national issues like climate, health care, and economic justice, while also delivering reliable and responsive constituent services for residents every day. Markey's campaign highlighted his partnership with the Wu administration to deliver major federal investments to Boston, such as helping to secure $472 million to replace the North Station Draw 1 Bridge, advancing clean energy and climate resilience efforts, and supporting improvements for Franklin Park. The senator also cited his work with Wu, 41, and U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley to introduce legislation that would make the MBTA free for all users and build on the mayor's pilot program that waives fares for three public bus routes in Boston. Markey said he was deeply honored to be endorsed by Wu, who he described as one of the boldest and most visionary leaders in America today. "Michelle and I don't just share values. We deliver results," Markey said in a statement. "From confronting the climate crisis to protecting our immigrant communities, to expanding affordable housing and building a city where every neighborhood can thrive, she is shaping the future of Boston with urgency." Markey added that he and Wu would work together to continue to fight back against Donald Trump's chaos. Wu was endorsed by Markey twice for mayor, including during her re-election bid last year when she smoked her principal challenger Josh Kraft, a philanthropist and son of the billionaire New England Patriots owner. Moulton, a Salem Democrat and Iraq War veteran, said when announcing his Senate bid that Markey should not be running for another six-year term at 80 years old, and that it's time for a new generation of leadership. Moulton was first elected to Congress in 2014 and ran unsuccessfully for president in 2020. Markey has spent 50 years in Congress. He was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1976 and was elected to the Senate in 2013. Boston City Councilor calls for Mayor Wu to roll back affordability requirements stalling development. Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn is calling for the mayor to roll back the city's inclusionary zoning requirements for new development that he says are halting housing production and worsening affordability in the hub. Flynn is proposing that the city's 20% inclusionary zoning requirement, which sets aside a certain percentage of units as affordable housing for new construction, go back to the 13% threshold it was at before the mayor's changes to the city law took effect in October 2024. The councilor recommended that the rollback stay in place for the next 5 years, depending on economic conditions, in a letter he wrote Monday to Mayor Michelle Wu and Chief of Planning Kairos Shen. Following several years of post-pandemic inflation, a high interest rate environment, rising construction costs, and tariffs, I believe it is long past time for elected officials and leaders in our city and state to acknowledge the reality that while we do not control many of the big picture economic conditions, We should do everything we can within our power to make any adjustments that will help spur development of housing and affordable units in our city, Flynn wrote. While these aforementioned factors are central to this issue, a 20% affordable housing rate is certainly not helping to produce enough new units to meet demand in Boston while facing such strong economic headwinds, the councilor added. Flynn cited unspecified reports that show housing production has dropped from 9,800 in 2020 to 2,389 in 2024 to just 852 in the first half of 2025, and that Boston lagged 16 peer cities in production in 2024. Under the Wu administration, the city's inclusionary zoning requirements increased from 13% to 17 to 20%, depending on the size of the building and affordability of income-restricted units, in October 2024, per the city website. The city policy was also updated to lower the threshold to trigger the requirement from 10 to 7 units for new construction. With progressive cities in the country at lower requirements, we must also prioritize Boston's future with a temporary rollback of IDP to potentially be reviewed for sunset in 5 years, depending on economic conditions, Flynn wrote. A higher percentage of units has been noble and with the best of intentions to address our affordable housing crisis for working families. But in these conditions, if we're producing less housing, we're also getting less affordable units for working families. Some housing is better than no housing. It's my hope that we have the courage to put politics aside, ignore the noise of social media, and make this adjustment with the best interest of Boston's economic volatility in mind, Flynn added. Flynn plans to introduce a resolution on Wednesday calling for the city council to back his proposal. Mayor Wu's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Expert: Massachusetts among worst states in SNAP payment errors fraud detection. The Bay State has one of the highest payment error rates in U.S. SNAP program, allows EBT vendors to self-certify, and ranks among the worst states in fraud detection. Massachusetts is among the worst states in the country in fraud detection, an expert says, as several public benefits fraud schemes have been uncovered recently by both federal and state investigators, and after the Herald published shocking claims of rampant SNAP fraud and lackluster efforts to stop it by a Department of Transitional Assistance whistleblower. When Massachusetts officials say they don't have a problem, they clearly have a problem. Massachusetts is in the top five of the worst states in fraud detection and in payment error rate for SNAP, said Haywood Talcove, the CEO of data analytics company LexisNexis's Risk Solutions Government Group. Payment error rate. Talcove pointed to data from a Biden administration audit of the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, in fiscal year 24, which found the Bay State to be among the five worst states in the entire country for its payment error rate. In that year, the USDA reported Massachusetts had a SNAP program payment error rate of 14.1%, of which the vast majority was in overpayments, 13.03%. Massachusetts received over $2.6 billion and more than $240 million per month in federal SNAP funding in fiscal year 24, equating to $364 million in erred payments that year, of which $338 million was in overpayments. Complete data from fiscal year 25 is not yet available. This is from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I've been using, just because it was from the Biden administration, takes out the Trump politics. And I would argue that number, 14.1%, is likely double, Talcove told the Herald. Massachusetts has just 11 people in the investigation unit, SIU, for EBT, and they're pumping $100 billion a year through it nationally. Talcove, who grew up in Danvers, has significant experience in identifying and combating public benefits fraud, boasting a resume that includes 2 years on U.S. Secret Service raids busting SNAP fraud rings nationwide. He has also testified before both the U.S. House and Senate on the issue of public benefits fraud. Transnational criminal organizations behind most of the fraud. When it comes to rooting out SNAP fraud in Massachusetts, Talco says it should start with eliminating the state's current self-certification policy to become eligible to accept EBT payments. Massachusetts has roughly 5,600 EBT vendors, of which 70% are convenience stores, he says. Talco says transnational criminal organizations use these businesses, most commonly convenience stores, as a vehicle to carry out significant amounts of SNAP fraud. What happens is, transnational criminal groups get involved, and they always tend to have some connection back to their home country. What they do is, they fill out the USDA paperwork to become an EBT retailer, which is done all by self-certification in Massachusetts. The USDA has 256,000 stores in its system, and you're not going to get audited, explained Talcove. These foreign criminal organizations get friends and teach them how to get stolen EBT cards, or they just flat-out steal identities in various ways, like through point-of-sale, POS, terminals at grocery stores where customers swipe their cards, usually a terminal that's been cloned from a bad third-party payment processing company. That allows them to pretend that they're entering food into the system, but they're just entering nonsense, and that's how they get their reimbursements from the USDA, he said. Similar operations were recently seen in Massachusetts, including the recent $1 million SNAP fraud scheme busted by the feds in early February. That scheme was carried out by a Dominican national, two illegal immigrants, and a green card holder who used stolen SNAP benefits to purchase quality meats and other foods to sell for a profit at their Lemonster restaurant, El Primo. In December, the U.S. Attorney's Office also announced the arrests of two Haitian nationals who ran a $7 million SNAP fraud scheme out of their tiny retail store in Mattapan. On top of this, the State Auditor's Office has uncovered roughly $34 million in SNAP fraud in fiscal year 23, 24, and 25. Turning over recipient data to the feds. This all as Governor Maura Healey still refuses to hand over personal information on Massachusetts' SNAP recipients, including immigration status, to the Trump administration and the USDA. Healey says the Trump administration has given her office no assurances that the data will not be passed on to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Talco says every state, including Massachusetts, needs to share that information with the federal government if any serious effort to root out SNAP fraud nationally were to be pursued. The only way to stop the fraud, because it's all connected across the country, is for all the states to share the data. For example, at LexisNexis, we see the same 10 identities being used in all 50 states. The states don't see it because they're operating in silos when it comes to sharing data. But it's the most effective tool to stop fraud and improper payments, argued Talcove. The people that are doing this are ghosts. They're not a constituent of Maura Healey. They're not a constituent of any of the House or Senate members. They are synthetic identities or stolen identities. And what people need to get through their brains is fraud prevention isn't benefit prevention. And integrity is not the opposite of compassion. It's what makes compassion sustainable, he said. Last week, the Herald reported shocking allegations made by a whistleblower working in the Massachusetts DTA, who detailed rampant fraud within the state's SNAP EBT program, dating an extreme uptick in fraud cases back to 2021 during the surge in illegal immigration under the Biden administration. They also noted several concerns with DTA upper management and leadership, including setting a tone of normalcy surrounding drastic increases in fraud throughout the state and in spite of intermittent outcries from staff. And this has been readings from the Boston Herald, Tuesday, February 24th, 2026, read to you by Steve Malisi. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day.
You were just listening to the Boston Herald on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny temperatures in the lower 30s, partly cloudy overnight, temperatures cold in the lower teens, and for Wednesday, some clouds, rain, and snow to start, accumulation 1 to 2 inches, temperatures in the upper 30s. The sun rose this morning at 6:26, setting at 5:28 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLPFL, WDJ. And Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
This is Ann reading from the Washington Post on Tuesday, February 24th. Trump's top general foresees acute risks in an attack on Iran. By John Hudson and Tara Kopp. As the Trump administration weighs an attack on Iran, the Pentagon's top general has cautioned President Donald Trump and other officials that shortfalls in critical munitions and a lack of support from allies will add significant risk to the operation and to U.S. personnel, according to people familiar with internal discussions. General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, expressed his concerns at a White House meeting last week with Trump and his top aides, these people said, cautioning that any major operation against Iran will face challenges because the U.S. munitions stockpile has been significantly depleted by Washington's ongoing defense of Israel and support for Ukraine. Kane's remarks at the White House meeting have not been previously reported. Separately, in Pentagon meetings this month, Kane also has raised concerns about the scale of any Iran campaign, its inherent complexity, and the possibility of U.S. casualties, one person said. The general has said that any operation would be made all the more difficult by a lack of allied support, this person said, speaking like others on the condition of anonymity to discuss private conversations. In a statement, Kane's office said that in his role as the president's top military advisor, the chairman provides a range of military options, as well as secondary considerations and associated impacts and risks to the civilian leaders who make America's security decisions. Kane, the statement adds, provides these options confidentially. White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly said Trump listens to a host of opinions on any given issue and decides based on what is best for U.S. national security. She described Kane as a talented and highly valued member of President Trump's national security team. Trump, after this article's publication, posted on social media that it is 100% incorrect that Kane is against us going to war with Iran. Trump said that the general would not like to see a military confrontation with Iran, but that if it did happen, it is his opinion that it will be something easily won. The people who spoke to the Post about Kane's thinking directly contradicted Trump's optimistic characterization. The White House meeting on Tuesday included Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and White House Advisor Stephen Miller, one person told the Washington Post. Kane's views, reported earlier by Axios, are seen as highly credible by the administration because of the successful execution of two other major operations he has overseen, the assault on Iran's nuclear sites in the summer and the January raid to capture Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Kane said one person familiar with his conversations will support whatever decision the president makes, as he did with previous operations, as does not want to be seen as taking any option off the table. The scale of an Iran campaign could vary significantly depending on Trump's objectives. Taking out Iran's missile program would require hitting hundreds of targets across the country more than three times the size of Iraq. Those targets could include missile launch sites, many of them mobile, supply depots, air defense systems, and the transportation networks used to move those weapons, a former defense official told the Post. If the objective is to overthrow Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, as Trump has mused publicly, the target set would expand dramatically to thousands of sites, including command and control nodes, security services, and key buildings tied to Khamenei. Such a campaign would extend for weeks or months, require much more munitions, and expose U.S. forces to more intense retaliation, the former defense official said. The administration has assembled a massive strike force in the Middle East, and Trump has acknowledged that he is also weighing a limited strike aimed at pressuring Tehran into a deal to restrict its nuclear program on terms favorable to Washington. Iran has expressed a willingness to make a deal, but disagreements remain over Iran maintaining a uranium enrichment capability, among other issues. Talks between U.S. and Iranian negotiators are scheduled to resume this week in Geneva. Some U.S. officials oppose a limited strike because it could trigger an unpredictable cycle of tit-for-tat violence, including Iranian attacks on U.S. military diplomats, personnel in the region, said a person familiar with the deliberations. Advocates for a limited strike point to Iran's modest response to previous U.S. and Israeli strikes, including telegraphed counterstrikes aimed at limiting the risk of U.S. casualties. But opponents say Trump's open deliberating about regime change and the growing influence of hardliners in Iran's military establishment may invite a more lethal response. U.S. allies in the region, some of whom met with Trump last week to convene his Board of Peace, also worry that a limited strike would push Iran away from the negotiating table. An attack on Iran could further strain U.S. relations with its regional allies. A senior Persian Gulf official told the Post that Arab countries have informed Washington that they would not allow their bases to be used for a strike against Iran. Iran's threat to retaliate against any country that supports the U.S. operation has also raised questions about Washington's ability to secure flyover rights. One former Pentagon official said the lack of Allied support significantly complicates the mission. How are we going to be able to do this, especially if the Arabs don't give us overflight? How are you going to hit hundreds, if not thousands, of targets across the country? The former official said. Two munitions critical to the defense of U.S. military personnel against Iranian-launched ballistic missiles, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, interceptors, and Patriot missile systems have been extensively used in recent military operations in the Middle East. Patriot missiles also remain one of the most in-demand items for Ukraine as it defends against Russian missile attacks. But the U.S. produces only several hundred of both defenses each year, far less than would be needed, said Ryan Brobst, deputy director of the Center on Military and Political Power at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. The Navy, too, has a limited supply of its standard missiles, a must-have if the U.S. is going to limit risk to the thousands of U.S. military forces that have surged to the region. But ship-launched SM-2, SM-3, and SM-6 munitions have been rapidly consumed as the Navy has protected vessels in the Red Sea against Iranian proxy forces in Yemen and defended Israel against ballistic missiles. Because of their complexity and production constraints, it can take 2 years or more to produce each replacement missile, said Mackenzie Eaglin, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. There's no quick fix to this problem, Eaglin said. The U.S. military's supply of those missiles is globally managed and allocated, meaning one pot is shared by commands worldwide depending on need. No one has everything they need, a U.S. official told the Post. Munitions stockpile levels dropped so low last year that the Defense Department abruptly requested almost $30 billion from Congress to purchase a range of high-end missiles and interceptors. The request was only partially fulfilled in the Pentagon budget passed last month, according to lawmakers. Katherine Thompson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, who recently left the Pentagon, said that the U.S. is not currently prepared to resource simultaneous conflicts, and that any extended conflict with Iran would likely come with significant trade-offs for higher priority interests. The U.S. has surged forces to the region in part to mitigate risk to U.S. personnel there and Israeli targets. But a dangerous numbers game persists. As long as Iran retains a missile arsenal, American-Israeli forces would have to absorb incoming fire or destroy Iran's launch sites at scale, a former defense official said. That is the dynamic, this person said. As the Trump administration deliberates, it has assembled the largest military buildup in the Middle East since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. On Monday, the U.S. ordered the Department of Non-Emergency U.S. Government personnel and family members from the U.S. Embassy to Lebanon amid fears that Iran's proxy Hezbollah could be drawn into the conflict. Trump's special envoy to the region, Steve Witkoff, told Fox News over the weekend that the president is curious why Iran hasn't capitulated to U.S. demands given the looming threat of a military attack. Why, under this pressure, with the amount of sea power and naval power over there, why haven't they come to us and said, "We profess we don't want a weapon, so here's what we're prepared to do." And yet, it's sort of hard to get them to that place, he said. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi responded on social media saying, "Curious to know why we do not capitulate? Because we are Iranian." The State of the Union brings a big audience for Trump, but does it matter? By Kat Sixrusky and Emily Davies. President Donald Trump will deliver his State of the Union address to Congress on Tuesday night at one of the most fragile moments of his second term as he confronts new Supreme Court limits on his agenda, vote anger over inflation, and growing cracks within his MAGA coalition ahead of the midterms. But during a time of hardened political divides, shrinking attention spans, and declining television viewership, it's unlikely that even one of Washington's most enduring political traditions can reset the course of his embattled administration, according to interviews with Republican political consultants, historians, and communications experts. The State of the Union remains one of the rare moments when Trump is guaranteed airtime across networks to speak directly to a nationwide audience. And the constitutionally mandated address to the legislative branch remains a powerful symbol of the separation of powers. But in the age of algorithm-driven social media feeds and bite-sized video clips, the audience for the speech is increasingly fragmented and entrenched in their political positions. The carefully crafted speeches are more likely than ever to be drowned out by memes and partisan fireworks as Americans increasingly experience the speech in clips online tailored for one party's narrative rather than through a more than hour-long network broadcast. This moment used to have a huge buildup to it, said Ron Bongean, a Republican strategist who previously served as a spokesman for congressional leaders. The expectations were sky high for presidents to knock it out of the park. Now it feels like when the speech is given on that Tuesday, by the next day you are talking about something else. Vice President J.D. Vance told Fox News that Trump will focus his speech on the economy, touting a Trump boom that will bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States and reduce energy costs for American households. The president will deliver that message to an increasingly skeptical public as his disapproval rating hit 60% for the first time since the aftermath of the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, according to recent Washington Post NBC Ipsos poll. The political forces buffeting his agenda are expected to be on full display under the Capitol Dome. He is likely to come face to face with some of the Supreme Court justices he called fools and lapdogs following their Friday decision to strike down many of the broad tariffs central to his economic agenda. Some Democrats are planning to walk out of the address or forego the event altogether, in part in protest of his approach to immigration enforcement amid a partial government shutdown caused by a standoff over funding for the Government of Homeland Security. And he'll confront members of his own party who are increasingly critical of his agenda, especially his foreign policy moves, as he considers launching an extended military assault on Iran as soon as this week. Trump is omnipresent on television, but the State of the Union could still provide the largest single night audience that he will attract before the midterms in November. Trump administration officials and advisors continue to project confidence that people will start to feel the effects of the economic policies in the next few months, which they expect to improve the midterms map, according to a person close to the White House who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss private conversations. In multiple meetings to discuss the midterms, officials have described the election as a game of inches, not a wave, and said the results will come down to the strength of each individual candidate and their fundraising operation, in addition to the economic reality. Recent Washington Post polling has found that Trump's worst issue is inflation, with 32% approval for how he has dealt with consumer prices. That could spell political trouble in November for Republicans, who made President Joe Biden's handling of inflation central to their 2024 campaign pitch. The Republican Party is struggling because the party lacks a strong contrast message to Democrats this cycle, given that they control the White House and Congress, said John McLaughlin, longtime Trump pollster. In part, some of the messaging challenge stems from how Americans consume news, McLaughlin said. During a presidential campaign, Trump travels the country to appeal directly to millions of people. Right now, he is spending most of his time managing parts of the government, so he is more dependent on media to amplify his talking points. But fewer than half of Americans consume news via right-of-center outlets, McLaughlin's polling has found. The State of the Union, he said, is an opportunity to reach a far larger and more diverse audience with a sharper message to voters. It's not like when you had the Trump 24 campaign, he said, so they have to get back into a campaign mode and campaign structure. An estimated 36.6 million people watched Trump's address to a joint session of Congress last year, according to Nielsen. The event provided Trump one of his largest audiences besides inauguration, but his speech was largely overshadowed by partisan theatrics. The most notable was the removal of Representative Al Green, Democrat, Texas, who was escorted out of the chamber after he stood up, shook his cane in the air, and shouted at Trump, had no mandate to cut Medicaid. Republicans sought to drown Green out by chanting USA. Meanwhile, other Democrats held up signs that said Save Medicaid and one that just read false. This year, more than a dozen Democratic lawmakers are planning to hold a rally on the National Mall to provide counter-programming to Trump's speech. House Democrats in the chamber, meanwhile, will host the family of deceased Jeffrey Epstein accuser Virginia Giuffre drawing attention to their continued investigation into the financier's sex crimes. Despite broadly declining interest in the speech, Trump, a former reality TV producer, has displayed a proficiency at creating viral moments during his annual addresses. During his 2020 State of the Union, First Lady Melania Trump awarded conservative news commentator Rush Limbaugh, who had recently announced he was battling advanced lung cancer, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The speech also featured a service member's surprise reunion with his wife and children following a deployment in Afghanistan and a surprise scholarship for a Philadelphia fourth grader. This year, Trump has invited the U.S. men's hockey team to attend the speech on the heels of their overtime gold medal victory at the Winter Olympics. The gold medal-winning U.S. women's hockey team declined the invitation. Before the social media era, presidents often drew larger audiences for their first addresses or times of crisis or scandal. More than 62 million viewers tuned in to hear President George W. Bush's justification for the imminent invasion of Iraq in 2003, and 53 million watched President Bill Clinton deliver his address in 1998, a week after revelations that he and former White House intern Monica Lewinsky had a sexual relationship and that he had urged her to lie about it. The speech is still widely treated as a political Super Bowl in Washington. Media companies deploy large staffs to cover the event and response late into the night. Hours before the president arrives, some lawmakers stake out prime seats so that they can greet the president as he moves through the U.S. House chamber. Members of the administration and outside lobbyists spend weeks trying to ensure that their pet issues get airtime in the speech. The format of the State of the Union has dramatically evolved since President George Washington started the tradition. For more than a century, most presidents delivered their update on the state of the country's affairs to Congress in writing, including President Abraham Lincoln's famous 1862 address amid the Civil War. More than a half a century later, President Woodrow Wilson broke with tradition and visited Congress for speech to present his plan for tariffs in 1913. All official Washington was agape last night over the decision of the president, the Washington Post reported at the time. The Post wrote that the presidential address on Capitol Hill were not to become a habit, but several months later he returned again to deliver his constitutionally mandated update. Wilson ushered in a new era of presidents delivering addresses to Congress in person, and later broadcasting those addresses to the American people. President Calvin Coolidge was the first president to broadcast the State of the Union over the radio in 1923, and later President Harry S. Truman delivered the first televised annual address. In an effort to expand the audiences, President Lyndon B. Johnson moved the address to the evening in 1965. That move ushered in the modern spectacle, which has escalated in showmanship since the Reagan era when he began bringing special guests into the address. But for more than a decade, the power of the president to reach a mass audience has been on the decline as cable and the internet provide Americans with many other viewing options during the State of the Union, said David Greenberg, a professor of history and of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. It becomes much harder to expect that you're going to get tens of millions of people sitting in front of their living room TV on a Tuesday night, he said. Judge Cannon orders secrecy for a report on Trump classified documents case by Perry Stein and Jeremy Roebuck. A federal judge in Florida blocked public release of special counsel Jack Smith's extensive report on the classified documents case against President Donald Trump, a resounding victory for Trump's efforts to block public viewing of what probably would be damaging details about his retention of classified materials after he left the White House in 2021. The decision Monday morning from a U.S. District Judge Eileen M. Cannon resulted from litigation that has dragged on for more than a year in her courtroom. Cannon ruled that releasing the special counsel report could violate grand jury secrecy rules and could result in impugning the presumption of innocence for Trump and his co-defendants in a case that did not result in guilty verdicts. The ruling can be appealed, although Trump and the Justice Department both opposed the public release of the report. First Amendment advocacy groups and media outlets pushed in Cannon's court for release. Smith charged Trump in 2023 with 40 counts of illegally retaining classified defense information and obstructing government efforts to retrieve the materials. Two of Trump's personal aides were charged with obstruction alongside him. Cannon dismissed those charges in a decision that broke with legal precedent, ruling that Smith was unlawfully appointed and therefore had no authority to bring charges. Her decision did not touch on the merits of the case, which Trump aides at the time believed was the strongest of the criminal cases against Trump that were brought during the Biden administration. Smith appealed the ruling but dropped the appeal after Trump won the 2024 presidential election, citing federal regulations that say a sitting president cannot be prosecuted. In her Monday ruling, Cannon lambasted Smith for compiling the report, even though she dismissed the charges in 2024. Using the discovery in the case to complete the report amounted to circumventing her ruling, she said. In the final days before Trump took office, Smith submitted the final report to then-Attorney General Merrick Garland. Garland did not push to release it because at the time, an appeal of Cannon's dismissal order was still pending as the Justice Department tried to resurrect the case against Trump's two co-defendants. To say this chronology represents, at a minimum, a concerning breach of the spirit of the dismissal order is an understatement, if not an outright violation of it, Cannon wrote. The court need not countenance this brazen stratagem or effectively perpetuate the special counsel's breach of this court's own order, she continued. Garland made public the first volume of Smith's report, which detailed the case that prosecutors built against Trump over his alleged attempts to obstruct the 2020 election results. For 137 pages, Smith detailed the incriminating evidence he says he collected against Trump over his two-year investigation and said he was confident that he had ample evidence to obtain a conviction in court. That case also never made it to trial, with the Justice Department asking a judge to dismiss it in the final weeks before Trump took office for his second term. The second volume of the special counsel report was expected to similarly detail the incriminating evidence Smith collected against Trump and reveal what would have been the special counsel's strategy at court. Prosecutors already said that some of the documents found in the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago, Trump's Florida home and private club, contained information about top-secret U.S. operations so closely guarded that many senior national security officials were kept in the dark about them. Trump and his attorneys first asked Cannon to block the release of the report before he was inaugurated for his second term. Cannon temporarily blocked the release on January 7, 2025, about 2 weeks before Trump took office. Once Trump regained the presidency, the Justice Department said it opposed releasing that report. Trump, in his personal capacity, also filed requests in Cannon's court to block the release. Cannon previously denied requests from two legal groups, the Knight First Amendment Institute and American Oversight, that have sought to present arguments in favor of disclosure. The groups had already asked the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit to intervene, an appeal that remains pending, with arguments tentatively scheduled for June. Judge Cannon's ruling continues a troubling pattern of decisions that shield the president from public scrutiny and place secrecy above the public right to know, Chioma Chukwu, executive director of American Oversight, said in a statement Monday. Scott Wilkins, senior counsel for the Knight Institute, called Cannon's decision impossible to square with the First Amendment. The defense attorney for Trump, Kendra Wharton, celebrated Cannon's decision on Monday, calling Smith's report illegal. Jack Smith was unconstitutionally appointed and his unlawful investigation was improperly funded with tens of millions of U.S. taxpayers' hard-earned dollars. Wharton said in a statement, any and all of Smith's poisonous tree should be treated accordingly and should never see the light of day. Smith has testified to Congress in recent months about his case against Trump. He has said that he is limited in what he can reveal, in part because of Cannon's prohibition on releasing the report. It is common practice for special counsels to release reports even if their investigations do not result in guilty verdicts. Special counsel Robert K. Herr, for example, released a report in 2024 detailing his investigation into whether President Joe Biden unlawfully retained classified materials after his vice presidency. The damaging report explained why Herr opted against charging Biden. Cannon attempted to differentiate the release of Smith's report from other cases, saying that there was no precedent for releasing a report in a case in which the charges have been dismissed and the defendants maintain their innocence. The lack of precedent existed largely because Cannon's order dismissing the case on the grounds that Smith's appointment was unlawful was itself unprecedented. The court strains to find a situation in which a former special counsel has released a report after initiating criminal charges that did not result in a finding of guilt, at least not in a situation like this one, where the defendants contested the charges from the outset and still proclaim their innocence, Cannon wrote. Governor Wes Moore's redistricting plan is poised to die. He's still fighting. By Aaron Cox. While Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Democrat, spent last week in verbal combat with President Donald Trump over a sewage spill, he was also quietly losing his biggest political battle at home. Moore's months-long fight to redraw Maryland's congressional maps and oust its lone Republican member of Congress produced zero movement among Democrats in the Maryland Senate. Despite a public pressure campaign without modern precedent in this deep blue state, which typically resolves intra-party fights behind closed doors, Tuesday's unofficial deadlines to act on mid-cycle redistricting ahead of the 2026 midterms will come and go without fellow Democrats heeding Moore's demands for a vote. The window of opportunity is closed for 26, said Maryland Senate President Bill Ferguson, Democrat Baltimore City, who refuses to redistrict, arguing that the state's Democrats have already gerrymandered as much as possible and that further attempts will backfire. The apparent loss, which Moore vehemently does not concede, draws a sharp contrast between himself and another potential 2028 Democratic presidential contender, California Governor Gavin Newsom, Democrat, who swiftly persuaded his state's legislators and voters to redraw five more Democratic-leaning seats in retaliation for Republican gerrymandering done at Trump's behest in Texas. Other potential 2028 presidential candidates also did not push through redistricting, but Moore stands alone as a Democrat who vowed to fight Trump with a redistricting scheme but failed to achieve it. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, another potential 2028 contender, cast redistricting in his state as a potential counterpunch to GOP map drawing in neighboring Indiana, for example. But it was a punch he never threw because Indiana's redistricting failed. Moore rejects the conventional wisdom that Maryland must pass a map before Tuesday, the candidate filing deadline, after which new congressional districts would require shifting the entire election schedule. These are artificial deadlines. These are deadlines that are made by politicians, Moore said in an interview, noting they can be changed by a simple vote. I will never stop fighting for democracy. I never have before, and I'm not going to start now. His staff is also developing a Plan B, according to someone with direct knowledge of the plans who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the strategy. The loss on anti-Trump policy follows a week in which Moore burnished his national reputation as an anti-Trump combatant with his ongoing feud with the president spanning days of news coverage. Democratic strategists say that by the time the 2028 presidential election rolls around, voters are more likely to remember the brand more staked out against Trump than the fact that he couldn't get redistricting passed. The 2028 presidential election isn't going to be decided on who won a redistricting fight in 2025 or 2026. Voters assess a candidate's entire profile, not just one moment, said Democratic strategist Liz Smith, who helped Pete Buttigieg launch his national profile. David Axelrod, Barack Obama's former political strategist, said that there's going to be a lot of water under the bridge between now and then. Newsom will get credit for winning a redistricting battle, but it's not clear Moore will suffer from losing his, Axelrod said. Obviously, it's a defeat when you can't get solidarity among your own party, and questions will be raised about whether you should have known that before you went down that road. But he's got enormous strength as well, Axelrod said. Being singled out by Trump for the Democrats who will be motivated by this has its own cachet. Earlier this month, Trump disinvited Moore, the lone black governor of a U.S. state, from a White House dinner Saturday night and called Moore not worthy and foul-mouthed. The president also accused Moore of mismanaging a massive sewage spill in the Potomac River. Moore, in turn, accused the president of ignorance. The Environmental Protection Agency has oversight over the spill, not Maryland. In a nationally televised town hall, Moore called Trump unhinged, and when asked whether he thought Trump is racist, Moore responded, "I think the question of is he racist should be posed to him. But frankly, I think his actions probably give the answer before he even has a chance to answer himself." Republicans have been eager to challenge Moore's redistricting effort in court because they thought they could save the state's only congressional Republican, House Freedom Caucus Chair Andy Harris, and possibly even pick up a seat. Wes Moore's failure is a stunning display of his inability to work with the supermajority of his own party, said Del Kathy Ziglia, Republican, Baltimore County, who would have been the GOP's lead plaintiff challenging a new map. Democrats hold 34 out of 47 Maryland Senate seats. Senate President Bill Ferguson saved him from national embarrassment, Ziglia said, adding that Moore has spent more time courting the national press than the senators in the Maryland Senate. Moore said his motivation on redistricting comes from two places, harms to his state and his perspective as a black man. Maryland has been hit harder than any other place in this country, Moore said in an interview, referring to federal layoffs, denial of federal emergency management agency aid, and threats of deploying the National Guard among the ways he argues that Trump has used the federal government to target Maryland. There is a bigger obligation that I do feel, Moore said, and I feel it as the only black governor in this country. Moore has labeled redistricting political redlining since a September speech to the Congressional Black Caucus, calling new congressional boundaries that oust black and brown officials akin to discriminatory housing practices that for generations made it more expensive to buy homes in black neighborhoods. Prominent black leaders, Representatives Emanuel Cleaver, the second Democrat Missouri, and James F. Clyburn, Democrat South Carolina, for example, will face difficult, if not impossible, reelection bids as a result of GOP redistricting. I use the words political redlining very intentionally because we are watching how political lines are being drawn to diminish power, black leadership, the same way that residential lines were used to diminish black wealth. And you cannot look at this assault that is taking place from this administration and not see how the political leadership is also just part of a much larger plan, Moore said, noting the disproportionately skyrocketing unemployment rate for black women. Maryland has a solemn obligation to understand the larger game that is going on and the larger role that we have to play to be able to combat it, he said. The White House did not respond to a request for comment. Moore has deployed his rhetoric in private meetings with lawmakers and dozens of national interviews since October, and repeated his plea in this month's State of the State address, casting Maryland as a critical player in undermining Trump's efforts to secure GOP power in the House of Representatives. The governor orchestrated Democratic Party stars to sell his case, including a six-page letter from Representative Jamie Raskin, a plea from influential black pastors, and visits to Annapolis last week from former Attorney General Eric Holder, chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat, New York. None of it has swayed Maryland's Senate to move, nor did quick passage of the legislation in the House of Delegates. After a private meeting with the Senate president that lasted more than a half hour, Jeffries told reporters, Bill Ferguson authentically believes that the votes don't exist in the state Senate to move forward. The only way to find out is allow an immediate up or down vote. Ferguson flatly refused. For the umpteenth time in the Senate, we generally do not bring things to the floor that don't have the votes to pass, he said, pointing out the chamber's debate procedures can suck up a large amount of time without leading to a vote. He argues that a new map would not survive a legal challenge, and if it failed, courts could draw new districts that would elect more Republicans. The map that we have today is our best option for fighting against this Trump administration, Ferguson said. What is happening in the mid-cycle redistricting is horrifying, and there is an active effort to disenfranchise black elected officials. It's unconscionable. It is unbelievable, Ferguson added, but what we have to do in Maryland is protect Marylanders. Senator Cheryl C. Kagan, Democrat Montgomery, an early and steadfast Moore supporter, said she doesn't believe the votes are there, so indulging the governor's request would waste limited time in a 90-day session. Other important legislation addressing critical issues would die when we ran out of time, she said. Other senators cast doubt on that argument. We've never had a debate on the issue, not even in the back rooms, said Senator Arthur Ellis, Democrat Charles. I believe if we have an honest debate on this issue, it will pass on the floor. Moore said he has no plans to relent. Democracy means we debate. Democracy means we test ideas. Democracy means compromise. And then democracy means that we vote. That is the basis of democracy, he said. And what we are seeing right now from the Maryland Senate is not democracy. What we're seeing from the Maryland Senate is the hiding behind archaic rules and almost this boss mentality that I think people don't like about politics. Is autism preventable in certain cases after all? Some scientists say yes. By Ariana Unjungcha. Obstetrician Jean Conry has long paid attention to the 1,300-day window, the months before conception, through a child's second birthday. Studies show nutrition and lifestyle during this period can shape pregnancy outcomes and the long-term health of the babies. Conroy began to wonder if such factors could also influence autism. She's now helping lead an educational push aimed at alerting women to their exposure to toxins, stress, and infections during this narrow and consequential window, guided by the idea that what happens then may subtly shape eggs or sperm and in turn influence a child's development long before pregnancy begins. The more we research, the more we see links between different chemical exposures and autism. So if we reduce those links, we will ideally reduce cases, Conroy said. For years, movements like this existed on the fringes, but recent studies are giving it new weight, raising a provocative question that was once almost taboo. Could some cases of autism actually be preventable? One peer-reviewed paper Generating Buzz in the Autism Research Community, published in December, argues that a staggering number, more than half of autism cases, could be prevented with the right interventions. It proposes a three-hit theory suggesting that genetic susceptibility combined with environmental exposure and prolonged period of physiological stress contribute to autism. Separately, two recent studies found that parents with the highest levels of an unusual sensitivity to everyday substances, even at low levels, as measured by self-reported symptom patterns and validated questionnaires, were 2 to 5.7 times more likely to report having a child with autism, prompting researchers to urge couples trying to conceive to minimize environmental exposures in their homes. Both lines of research rest more on hypothesis than on settled evidence. The science linking environmental exposure to autism remains preliminary, defined by suggestive correlations rather than demonstrable causation. But still, the ideas are helping fuel a broader cultural focus on preconception health. On Instagram and TikTok, a growing number of wellness influencers have embraced what they call trimester zero, advising women, often mixing science-backed guidance with largely unproven claims, to stop wearing nail polish, take specific supplements, meditate, and work to lower cortisol levels before conceiving. Books with titles like The Fertility Formula, The Preconception Revolution, and 9 months is not enough promote the idea that women are more in control of the health of their fetuses than they might think. The new interest in the preconception period comes amid renewed national attention to environmental explanations for autism. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has drawn widespread criticism for claiming that an environmental toxin is responsible for rising autism rates and for describing the condition as a preventable disease. Many autism researchers disputed those assertions, arguing that increases in prevalence are more plausibly explained by expanded diagnostic criteria and greater awareness, and that autism is not a disease at all, but a form of human diversity. The idea of prevention does not merely promise scientific clarity, it also assigns responsibility. If autism is shaped not only by biology, but by environmental conditions that governments and institutions can influence, uncomfortable ethical questions inevitably follow. David Beversdorf, a University of Missouri professor who studies autism and stress, supports the major medical society's recommendation that OBGYNs counsel patients on diet and fitness before conception. But he is wary of extending that routine guidance to broad warnings about environmental exposures, citing limited evidence and the risk of impractical or counterproductive advice. We don't have the evidence yet to say what you need to do that pushes the advice in to scare things, he said. I'd be nervous going that far. The roughly 3 years spanning the months before conception, pregnancy, and early infancy are a uniquely sensitive period in human development, one that can change a person's lifetime health trajectory. Research, much of it funded by the National Institutes of Health, has linked habits and exposures during this period to obesity, asthma, childhood cancers, decreased intelligence, and working memory, and numerous other issues. One of the studies that has drawn a lot of attention recently is by Robert Nevio, a researcher at the University of California at San Diego, known for his work with mitochondria, the cell's powerhouses. Nevio and his team argue for a reframing of how autism is thought of. Instead of almost fixed genetic conditions, they suggest it may be better understood as a metabolic and inflammatory syndrome shaped by both biology and environment. At the center of his theory is the cell danger response, a temporary survival state triggered by perceived threat. When activated, mitochondria shift from supporting growth to signaling distress, slowing development, to allow for repair. Problems arise, Nevio and his colleagues say, when this response fails to shut off. In a three-hit model, autism risk emerges when genetic vulnerability meets an early environmental trigger, followed by prolonged activation of the danger response during critical periods of brain development. The stressor might be a viral infection or inflammation due to air pollution. From this view, autism reflects development under chronic biological stress, a brain adapting to a world that, at a cellular level, never quite feels safe. Nevio believes that figuring out who might be more susceptible to autism, perhaps by analyzing genetic variants, metabolic biomarkers, brain scans, and early environmental exposures, could open a window for intervention, allowing clinicians to make targeted changes before autism fully emerges. He often draws a parallel to phenylketonuria, or PKU, a rare metabolic disorder in which the body cannot break down a particular amino acid, leading to seizures, intellectual disability, and other serious complications. Before its cause was understood, PKU was considered untreatable. Today, however, it is routinely managed through early detection, a strict low-protein diet, specialized medical formulas, and in some cases, medication. PKU, the reason universal newborn screening exists, Nevio noted. The lesson, he argues, is not that all children are at risk, but that some are more sensitive than others. The key is early identification, he said. There is a subset of children who may be especially responsive to changes in their environment. A related theory of how autism can develop starts with the parents. Claudia S. Miller, professor emeritus in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at University of Texas Health at San Antonio, has theorized that autism may in some cases be linked to a significant chemical exposure experienced by one or both parents, such as toxic mold, that leads to chronic condition known as chemical intolerance. People with chemical intolerance, which scientists believe may be due to immune signaling, neuroinflammation, metabolic stress, nervous system sensitization, or combination of the above, can develop severe symptoms, including headaches, fatigue, and confusion when exposed to everyday substances like household cleaners, reactions that most people do not experience. Miller suggests that chemical intolerance involves mast cells, which serve as first responders in the immune system. When triggered by chemicals or viruses, these cells release inflammatory molecules that produce allergy-like reactions. She theorizes that this inflammatory response could in turn disrupt typical brain development and lead to autism. In 2024, Miller and her colleagues published an analysis showing that in a group of nearly 8,000 U.S. adults, parents with chemical intolerance scores in the top 10th percentile were 5.7 times likely to have a child with autism when compared with those in the bottom 10th percentile. Those findings were replicated in a study published in January 2026 in the Journal of Xenobiotics, which examined children in five countries. In Italy, India, and the United States, children born to parents with the highest levels of chemical intolerance had more than a twofold increased risk of autism. In Mexico, the risk was 1.9 times higher. No association was found in the Japanese data, though researchers suggested cultural differences in diagnosis and awareness may have influenced the results. Neither study establishes causation, but she said that both raise enough questions about a possible link that in recent years Miller has worked alongside physicians to encourage screening of expectant parents for chemical intolerance and to offer environmental counseling when appropriate. She notes that with tens of thousands of synthetic chemicals present in everyday products, many introduced during the surge of industrialization after World War II, the number of potential triggers is vast. Our world is totally different than when our grandparents were younger, she said. Conry is a physician outside of Sacramento who heads the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics, of which the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, one of the country's most influential medical societies, is a member. She recounts that she's had several aha moments in her career when it comes to environmental exposures and pregnancy. After learning about lead-contaminated lipstick and serious birth defects in babies born to women who live in farming communities, and has dedicated the past few years to convening seminars, speaking at trainings, and other events to educate doctors and patients about how to minimize toxic exposures. Conry believes assessing exposures at home, work, and the community should be a routine part of a fertility consult. She said the idea is not that parents can or should engineer perfect outcomes, but that small changes made early may shift probabilities at the margins. Helen Tager-Flusberg, director of Boston University's Center for Autism Research Excellence and a founder of a coalition of autism scientists calling for more rigorous research, said there is little evidence that specific interventions during the preconception window could make a significant difference. She cautioned that focusing on this period is premature and possibly harmful, given the current limits of the science. She pointed to the past when both researchers and the public wrongly blamed so-called refrigerator mothers who were cold or emotionally distant and their parenting for autism. For decades now, we've done too much as a society to make women feel the burden is on them, she said. She said the best advice for women considering pregnancy hasn't changed for decades. Take prenatal vitamins with folic acid, eat a healthy diet, stay fit, and avoid drugs, alcohol, and smoking. Tager-Flusberg said there is stronger evidence for other autism risk factors, one being several high-impact genes that put some kids at risk for a more severe form of the condition. Should women be allowed to screen for them in the womb? She said the links between parental age and autism are far stronger than those found for exposures such as BPA, phthalates, and other environmental factors. In theory, the medical community could advise women to have children in their 20s and men before their late 30s or early 40s to reduce autism rates. But she noted that such guidance raises broader societal concerns about reproductive autonomy, gender equality, economic realities, as well as a risk of stigmatizing older parents. These are new territories, she said, and we are not ready as a society to be thinking about them. As Andrew fell, Queen Elizabeth II held out hope and Charles and William fumed, by Carla Adam. As sordid allegations engulfed Prince Andrew, the middle of her three sons, Queen Elizabeth displayed the eternal hope of a mother. Charles, heir to the throne, showed the cold impatience of a sibling, and William, the embarrassed dismay of a nephew. Countless families deal with a difficult relative. In the House of Windsor, he was the not-so-grand Duke of York, now reduced to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, after being stripped of his royal titles over his ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Andrew has long been a thorn in the royal family's side as he denied allegations of sexual misconduct, and yet again and again new evidence revealed his ties to Epstein were far closer and went on far longer than he admitted. But the three generations of the royal family each confronted the challenge differently, reflecting their own personal stake in Andrew's downward spiral. Last week, after Mountbatten Windsor was arrested in connection with potential misconduct during his time as a trade envoy, King Charles III issued a terse first-person statement, extremely rare for a British monarch. "Let me state clearly, the law must take its course," Charles said. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. This is Anne saying goodbye, and I will talk with you again soon.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny, temperatures in the lower 30s, partly cloudy overnight, temperatures cold in the lower teens, and for Wednesday, some clouds, rain, and snow to start, accumulation 1 to 2 inches, temperatures in the upper 30s. The sun rose this morning at 6:26, setting at 5:28 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with her hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
Hey, Alex, how did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom! I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. feedingamerica.org/act now. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You can't escape a traffic jam.